So some of you already know this. My dad just moved to Florida this week. Big week. But before he left, he spent a few nights with us. And it gave us some good time together before he was gone. And it was fun to think about what it means to be, and we had some conversations about this, what it means to be his son. And because we've started reading Genesis together, I've been thinking about what it means to be in my dad's likeness after his image. This is how Genesis describes the relationship between a parent and a child. If you have your Bible with you, open to Genesis chapter 5, a few chapters forward, verse 3. And this is from the ESV, chapter 5, verse 3. We hear this: when Adam lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. I've also been noticing my kids in my own likeness after my image. For instance, yesterday, Becca asked me if she could go on a run and meet Jane and I down at Story Coffee, two of my favorite things. She is so clearly of my own likeness and after my image. My heart was warm. But, right, we're not just talking about the cute similarities. We're talking uncanny likeness and image. Some of this clearly not learned, but inherited. So this week, as we get ready to welcome our incoming sixth graders into our summer youth group activities on Wednesday nights, two distinct events come to my mind, almost 25 years apart. First, there was Becca's very first youth event ever. She told me this morning that she's bummed that she can't be here. She's with my nephew watching him because he's not feeling well. But she apparently loves hearing stories about herself. So she has permission for me to share this. But her first youth event ever, back in the pre-COVID days, we were still doing monthly events with the other churches on our zone. And we were playing this game together when Becca figured out how to essentially hack the game. She would do this particular thing at a particular moment, and it would cause another student to lose. And it wasn't cheating. It was just super annoying, and it kind of ruined the spirit of the game for everyone. And yet, every time a student got frustrated, it just seemed to fuel Rebecca. She would laugh even harder, and she would find it that much more funny that people were frustrated. And I'm watching this at her first event, and I'm recognizing it immediately and am horrified. Because 25 years earlier, there was a man named Bill Nail who volunteered to work with middle school students. Poor man. He had no idea what he had signed himself up for. It was the summer before I started sixth grade, and I got invited to go to Waterworld with his group. I terrorized Bill that day. Now, I can't really get into my sixth grade brain. I have no access to like why I thought it was funny, but I basically committed myself that day to messing with him, flipping his raft again and again and again on the lazy river, tripping him as we were walking up water slide stairs, splashing him relentlessly in the wave pool, and with haunting likeness, I can see my image in Becca. The more annoyed he got, the funnier I thought it was. The more committed I became to it. Bill is a saint and was truly one of the first people to show me the love of Jesus. I couldn't now at this point in my life tell you anything that he taught me, but he never let me push him away, and I tried. He just kept showing up. As a side note, if any of you want to be a Bill in the life of a middle schooler, and why wouldn't you after a sales pitch like this, Wednesday nights, come spend some time with our students. I promise you, not all of them are like me and Becca. The likeness shared between parent and child is fascinating, right? To see a parent's image in his or her child. Kids in the room. Like, have you ever been told that you look like one of your parents? Have you ever been told that you act like one of them? Or have a similar personality? I see some of the kids' hands going up. Well, Genesis wants to draw an important comparison for us. Look at the way Adam fathers a son in his own likeness after his image. Look at the parent and the child. See their similarities from one generation to the next. And then notice another relationship. Just two verses earlier in chapter 5, we read, when God created humankind, he made them in the likeness of God, male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them human when they were created. The very next verse is the one we read earlier about Adam fathering his son in his likeness and his image. And a couple of things just immediately jump out to me as I read this. First, where only Adam fathers children, God creates them. Three times we're told in this short verse that this work was purposeful, that God created humans on purpose, and he blessed them and he named them. However, Adam isn't said to create his children. He fathered his children, which means he definitely helped make them, but he basically had no say in what genetic material each of his kids got to work with. He got what he got, and that's where Adam's fathering began. What Adam couldn't control in nature, he would need to make up for and nurture. There are aspects of a child that appear to just be hardwired in. It's in the genes. But then there are all of these aspects of a child that are caught, whether the parent meant to pass them along or not. And then there are all of these aspects that are taught on purpose. All of this to say, likeness and image is actually a bit dynamic, right? A child isn't a clone of their parents, no matter how much they look or act alike. And at the same time, children can choose to be more and sometimes less like their parents. But no matter what, a child does carry something of the parent. A child, in many ways, represents the parent wherever he or she goes. And this is exactly the comparison that the author of Genesis wants us to see. In the same way that a child represents something of their parent to the world, so a human, every human, is intended to represent God to the world. And this is by God's creative design. The word create, repeated three times here in chapter 5 in just these couple verses, is intended to send us right back to Genesis chapter 1 that we heard Jane read for us earlier, where God created. Chapter 1 has two main goals for anybody who starts reading the Bible. The first is to show us God as creator. Genesis 1 is not shy about this claim, that everything that exists, seen and unseen, is made by God. And the second is to show us our place in that creation, in relationship to that creator. So if you flip your Bible back a couple pages to chapter 1, I just want to show you something, how our passage is framed. In verse 1, we read that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If you flip to the end of our passage, chapter 2, verse 3, we read, "So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." God creates in the first verse. God rests from his creative work in the last verse. But as the definitive act of creation, in verse 26, we get God speaking to God's own self, saying, "Let us make humans in our image, after our likeness." And then in verse 27, "So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." You hear it, right? It's just relentless. God created, he created, he created three times, just like in chapter 5, right? We're supposed to hear this echo. We're supposed to understand what God is doing here in chapter 1, creating humans in his likeness and after his image. And then the only way to understand what God is doing is to compare or to look at the relationship between a parent and their children. Human beings are not clones of God, even if we bear his image and likeness. Somehow, a man and a woman can both simultaneously bear God's image, can both be seen in the likeness of God. This is where we need to sort of step back for just a second and to understand what this language would have meant in the ancient world. So if you were a king or a queen, right? It's fun to imagine being king or queen for a day. If you were a king or a queen, you might create a statue of yourself and set it up in various parts of your empire. Those of you kings and queens of your own home, could you imagine setting up a statue of yourself in all of the rooms in your home? Just so anybody who goes into those rooms knows who's the boss. That would be awkward. But this image made in your likeness in the ancient world would represent your rule and your authority in each of those places. That's what you were doing. You could even name a person, if you especially trusted them, or people as your personal representatives. So they might travel your empire for you and speak on your behalf as your representative, representing you and your will, your wishes to the people. And they would be considered an image of you, given your likeness. This is exactly what God is doing in Genesis 1. God has made the earth a place full of life, and he created specific beings, us, who he entrusted with the awesome privilege and responsibility of being his representatives in all the world, of carrying out his work and his purposes. And so as we read the creation account and we hear that humans were made to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth and to subdue it and to have dominion over every living thing, we consider what it means to have God's likeness, to be made in God's image. And we realize that if we're going to represent God, we have to look to God. We have to see who God is and what God is like and how God goes about his work so that we can do ours as he does his. And so the question, like, who is this creator God? And what is he up to? And this is where Genesis 1 takes us for a little bit of a ride. Here's what it says, that God takes formless and void waters. Scholars have tried to depict what this might be forever, but it, essentially one translator calls it the wild and waste. These waters are chaotic. They are a place of almost sheer nothingness. There is no life or substance here. And into this void, God speaks, naming something like light, and light just exists. And then as the story unfolds, he then begins to distinguish between the light and the dark. He begins to distinguish between the waters above and the waters below. He then begins to make a distinction between the waters below and the land. And with words, God names reality, and he begins to carve out and create space for life. And then he fills all of those spaces. God is fruitful. God multiplies life. And then he designates a representative to work with him. That's what we've been called to do, to work with him, to work for him in these spaces. We get to cultivate life, maintain it, keep things in order, help it flourish. You can see how the laws of physics established by God overlap with God's decision to make people in his own image, because anything that is ordered, that is left alone, that is neglected will decay and fall apart and become disordered. And so God entrusts the ongoing order and life of creation to creatures that bear his image and likeness, that will stay invested in keeping this life-giving order intact. He's given us the task of governing it, nurturing it. Okay, so if Genesis 1 tells us that this is what God is doing, like what does this actually mean for us? On one hand, it means that we have been given incredible power. Right? That we, in the likeness of God, that we have been entrusted with the ability to bring order from chaos. We help fill this space with image bearers, more humans made in the likeness of God. We also speak with words that can order reality, just as God speaks order into the universe. And I want to give you a quick example of this. Ali said I could share this, but we had a ridiculously amazing gift last week. Multiple people have reached out to me and talked to me about how life-giving Ali's message was. She got up here and she preached. I had the privilege of meeting with her the very first time when she had a notebook full of ideas. Now, if you don't know this about Allie, she has been in the church her whole life. She has heard plenty of sermons, lots of bad ones. She has so much knowledge that when I told her, like, your theme is church and community, she just in a notebook started jotting down all of these ideas and themes. And so we sat down and she starts opening this folder and it's like, okay, what's your message? And she like starts flipping and it's like full of ideas and thoughts and like little tidbits, and it was formless and without void. It was chaos. It was so many true and good thoughts, but not yet in a form that could bring life for us. And over a period of time, she began to name the main point of her message. She began to name each of the sort of sub-points she was making. And this thing came to life. And even across video, there were people who found themselves deeply impacted by the words and the message that Ali brought. What did I just say? We speak with words that can order reality, that can bring life into the world, just as God speaks order and brings life into the world. And we witnessed that last week. So cool. Why do you think the Bible cares so much about how we speak? Right? If you scan through Proverbs and James and Jesus, again and again, the Bible is obsessed with the words we use and how we speak and what, because our words have the ability to bring life. And our words have the ability to crush someone's spirit. Our ability to speak, to name, is a central part of what scientists do as they try to understand the world that we've been given by God. We see the first human in Genesis 2 doing this very thing as he names, sorts the animals into their kinds. Here in Genesis 1, we see God bring order out of chaos. And order is where life can flourish. And so we become people who imitate God in this as we order the world on behalf of God. And yet, there are two ways things can go terribly wrong, and I want to say something about each of these really quickly. One is that we can corrupt the order and distinctions made by God. So in Genesis 1 and 2, we're told that humans, male and female, are made equally in God's likeness and image. There is an essential equality to the two parts. And yet in chapter 3, something fundamentally changes between male and female. The two are no longer equal, but distinct. They're no longer equal, but distinct. They become distinct and ranked. The male assumes a position of authority over the female. He names her completely different from himself, not as an image-bearing female, but as though she were one of the animals that he had just named. Something is deeply broken. And while the man and the woman actually can still be fruitful, the fruit of the man's power over the woman is seen in the next chapter, where one son murders the other son. The fruit of their lives is rotten and is death and chaos. Rather than life, they are sowing death and chaos into the world, made in God's image. They do not look very much like God in how they order their lives. So we can corrupt God's order. We can take male and female to mean things other than what they meant, than what God meant. The second thing we can do to make things go wrong is to then create unnecessary categories, new distinctions designed only to divide. We have an example of this in our history. When humans start to distinguish people based on the color of their skin, we created a distinction designed to steal and kill and destroy. A distinction as meaningless as the color of someone's hair, right, became a way of valuing human lives, where we began to say that some lives were more important than others, some more human than others, some bearing God's image while others not. It would be utterly insane to suggest that people with blonde hair are in any way dumber than people with any other hair color. Even though we have lots of jokes suggesting that that might be true. But there's no basis in reality for that distinction. And so, in the same way, this act of naming black and white and distinguishing between two groups and elevating one above the other has in our history brought nothing but chaos and death and disorder into the world. God has given his image bearers a ridiculous amount of power. What a privilege it is to serve God as his representatives in the world. But with this privilege comes incredible responsibility. It's a responsibility to use God's power well and wisely. When we do this, we will bring order and life to our neighborhoods and to the nations. We will show people what God is like and who God is. We will continue the work of Jesus, who came as the image of God, making visible the one who is invisible. And so I wonder for you today, as you have heard our passage, have considered what it means to be made in the image and likeness of God, like, where is God inviting you to show up as his representative today and this week and this year? Like, where is God inviting you to bring order where there is chaos, to create space for life to flourish? Is it in your home? Or your office, or your neighborhood? Is it at a local city planning meeting? Is it just right here in this community? Where is it that God is inviting you to show up as a creative, life-giving force? To get us started, to get us moving, so we could practice taking action. We come to the table of Jesus this morning, because here, united by the Spirit of Jesus, we learn once again what God is like. Right? We see tangibly God's love as Jesus lays down his life for us. And we hear Jesus saying to us, "This is the love of the Father. Go and do likewise." And so may we this morning come to the table so that we might be formed into the image of God, the Father, maker of heaven and earth.